The next few weeks, I spent little time around her and didn't talk to her unless I absolutely had to. I starved my eyes from her as well. Then I found out she'd just had a baby, and all she could do was talk about her new daughter. She plainly loved her husband very much. At this time, my attractions went down, but not quite out. Later, some of the new engineering processes she put into place began to take some heavy criticism, and I saw that her disposition wasn't so light and airy after all. She could be downright shrewish. Today, she's just a friend. I'm not even attracted to her anymore. Starving the attractions. That was proper processing. Patricia had an entry visa, but the attractions were processed properly and generated few impure thoughts. You see, we can't eliminate attractive women from our lives, but we can shield ourselves from the early attraction phase until they become only friends. This proper processing is called starving the attractions. It's a concept that reminds me of an old cheer from my college days at Stanford. If you can't win, cheat. If you can't cheat, stall. If you can't stall, quit. Less than admirable, but funny in its way, and somewhat applicable here. Starving the attraction is a stall tactic. You'll see it in detail later, but active stalling waits for the facts that quickly process the relationship beyond the danger zone, where it generates no impurity. What happens if we don't starve the attractions? What if we play with the attractions a little? Won't the passage of time kill the attractions anyway? Most of the time, yes, but you can't take a chance. An improper relationship is not pleasing to God, no matter how innocent it appears. In summary, you have a mind that runs where it wills. It must be tamed. Our best tactic is to starve the attractions, limiting the generation of impure thoughts and the damage they bring to our marriage relationship. A corral for your Mustang mind. We said earlier that our minds are like wild Mustangs running free. Mustangs have two characteristics that resemble male brains. First, the Mustang runs where he wills. Second, the Mustang mates where he wills and with whom he chooses. There are mares everywhere. And if a Mustang doesn't happen to see one nearby, he'll sniff the wind and, sensing the mare over the horizon, he'll run over there and mate. This trait is similar to the wild donkey that God talked about through the prophet Jeremiah. A wild donkey accustomed to the desert, sniffing the wind in her craving. In her heat, who can restrain her? Any males that pursue her need not tire themselves. At mating time, they will find her. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 24. Can you control the Mustang? Can you run him down on foot or simply wag your finger and admonish him? No, of course not. Then how do you keep him from running and mating where he wills? With a corral. Currently, your mind runs like a Mustang. What's more, your mind mates where it wills with attractive, sensual women. They're everywhere. With a Mustang mind, how do you stop the running and the mating? With a corral around your mind. Let's expand a bit on this metaphor to help you better understand our goal of reining in our roving minds. Once you were a proud Mustang, wild and free, sleek and rippling, you ranged the hills and valleys, running and mating where you willed, master of your destiny. God, owner of a large local ranch, noticed you from a distance as he worked his herd. Though you took no notice of him, he loved you and desired to make you his own. He sought you in many ways, but you ran from him again and again. One day he found you trapped in a deep, dark canyon with no way out. With a lariat of salvation, he gently drew you near, and you became one of his own. He desired to break you, that you might be useful to him and bring him further joy. But knowing your natural ways and how you love to run free with the mares, he set a fence around you. This corral was the perimeter of the eyes. It stopped the running and kept you from sniffing the winds and running wildly over the horizon. While the corral stopped the running, it hasn't yet stopped the mating. You mate in your mind through attractions, thoughts, and fantasy, flirting and neighing lustily at the mares inside or near your corral. You must be broken. Closer and closer. In light of this picture, let's look at four categories of attractions that have come or will come your way. The first category is your visual attraction to the strangers we spoke of earlier, the joggers, receptionists, and pinups. Because we've established a defense perimeter of the eyes, our corral, these are now over the horizon. We can't run there anymore. They no longer create attractions. But there are still plenty of attractions within range of the corral. Categories 2 through 4 include the women who are not strangers, the women you interact with in life, the live attractions. In the second category are the women you aren't attracted to and don't generate impure thoughts. They can include your friends, acquaintances, co-workers, and church members. Your friend Joe may notice someone and say, "Wow, look at her, she's hot." You respond in mild surprise, saying, "I guess so. I've worked with her so long, I don't even think of her in those terms. She's just a friend." Your defense against this category of women is a simple monitoring, to make sure you notice early if one of them takes a step toward your corral. The third category is likely the most dangerous of all. These are the women you know and interact with and who hit your attractions buttons, like Rachel, your new coworker, or maybe the new worship leader who thrills your soul with her keyboard and worshipful heart. You nay, drawing them toward your corral, if only in your mind. Perhaps one of them has noticed you as well. Attracted to you, she trots purposefully toward your corral. Flattered, you snort majestically and stomp your foot and toss your head. Looking at her brings much pleasure. Pushing the boundaries, you stretch your head over the fence, nuzzling a bit through private lunches and close conversations. Worst of all, your Mustang mind can do something a real Mustang could never do. Open the gate of the corral, and not just mentally. Duane told us of a cousin who divorced his wife of 26 years after falling head over heels for another woman. "I just didn't know what to say to my cousin," he told us. "He got carried away and he wasn't going to stop seeing her. There was just no talking to him." You might say you could never open the gate of your corral to someone in the way Duane's cousin did, but look at the statistics for the church, friend. Our divorce rates are no different from the world's. Christians everywhere are separating or recovering from adulterous affairs born of men who open the corral of their minds. Without defenses, it could happen to you. The last category includes those women who are already inside your mental corral. Your first thought may be that only your wife is in this category, but there are others whom God has placed close to you. This category can include the wife of your close friend. You'll share restaurant tables with them, create joyful memories with them, and pray earnestly with them. Emotionally, you'll be close, but you must not lurk. Also, inside your corral may be an old girlfriend to whom you're still deeply attached. She was in your corral long before your wife, but she's never been sent out toward the horizon. You mate easily with her in your mind because of your many trysts together. Mentally, she's still right next to you. Then there's your ex-wife, perhaps the mother of your children. Because of those precious little ones, she'll usually live near you. Because of your former intimacy, she may seem yours for the taking in your mind. You remember the thrills and feel free to play with the thoughts, but you must lead her out of your corral toward the safe horizon. The perimeter of the mind processes the live attractions that canter up over the horizon and pass our corrals. By starving the attractions, these women retreat to safety zones of friendship or acquaintance, where they no longer threaten our purity. Remember what Kirk said about Patricia? After starving the attractions, she became just a friend, and he wasn't attracted to her anymore. Most women won't hit any attraction buttons at all, of course. As they enter your life, they simply trot past your corral toward the horizon. You don't notice them, and they don't notice you. They are and will be merely friends, acquaintances, and co-workers, somewhere off on the horizon. But those who do attract you and do approach your corral must not be given any reason to come closer or even approach the gate, where you might, in a moment of weakness, let her in. Preventing sad stories. Don't you owe it to your wife to put up a mental defense perimeter? You must protect your wife and kids from attractions outside your corral. Otherwise, you'll have a sad story to tell, like the one we heard from Jack. Jack was involved in full-time Christian ministry, Standing Strong. He had no mental defense perimeter, however, because he blissfully thought he didn't need one. As a result, he allowed Mary to come too close to his corral. Mary attended my church and was involved in the music ministry, Jack told us. Because of my skills and position in the church, I was involved in many activities with her. We were in a small worship band, and during practices, I noticed she began smiling in that certain way. She was pretty, and I was attracted. But I didn't give it much thought until she kept smiling at me. I got to thinking about it. The attractions were growing, and I felt a little excited and pleased with myself. One day, she stopped by my office and caught me alone. She began pouring out her troubles with her husband. As a minister, I often did counseling, so I felt I should listen. She started crying, and I put my arms around her, feeling sorry for her. She snuggled in a little, and I kind of liked it. She left, and nothing came of it, but now I was thinking about her constantly. Mary and I happened to take the same road to work, and I noticed she would be watching for me each morning, waving and smiling. At practice, she was more and more flattering of my musical talents. She looked at me with those eyes, even when I preached, smiling slightly, though sitting right next to her husband. It was kind of naughty and thrilling. I began doing the strangest things, like driving miles out of my way to her office just to see her car. What in the world did I gain by seeing her car, for Pete's sake? But it was romantic somehow. Finally, a few weeks later, we were alone, and I kissed her. I knew that kiss would end my career at my church, but I couldn't help myself. The attraction had grown too strong. Jack's career, marriage, and relationships with his children were severely damaged that afternoon. He said it could never happen, but it did happen because Jack lacked a defense perimeter. Your wife and kids deserve a defense, friend. You never know who will gallop near your corral. Chapter 15, Approaching Your Corral. Here's another helpful way of analyzing the live attractions in your life and what they mean for your mental defense perimeter. Let's think about two types of women who will approach your corral. Women you find attractive and women who find you attractive. Both categories have similar defenses, each designed to starve the attractions until she trots off toward the horizon. Here's a closer look. Women you find attractive. If you find someone attractive, your first line of defense is a proper mindset, which is this. This attraction threatens everything I hold dear. It may not appear threatening early in the attraction when everything seems innocent. Remember, though, that attractions grow quickly and can destroy your marriage. Even if your marriage manages to survive, at the very least, the lurking will weaken the foundation of your marriage and rob your wife of your full captivation. Your second line of defense is to declare, "I have no right to think these things." State this to yourself clearly, decisively, and often. You don't even know this woman. Who are you to be attracted to her? Didn't your master give you your wife? The third line of defense is to heighten your alert. What do you normally do when you feel threatened? You take off your jacket and breathe deeply. You ready yourself for what's coming. Suppose you are a bouncer at a dance club, checking IDs and tickets, joking with the customers. One night, five men in black leather loudly roar up on motorcycles, looking surly and arrogant. Would you relax and back away from the door? Not on your life. Without hesitation, you'd step up to the door and stand erect, ready to confront the threat. Consider the old Star Trek television series. What did Captain Kirk do when danger approached? He cried, "Red alert, shields up!" In a similar vein, when an attractive woman approaches your corral, your defense perimeter must immediately respond, "Red alert, shields up!" With your mindset transformed, you won't let her near the corral. The attraction will begin to starve and she'll drift back toward the horizon. How can you make sure that will happen? Bounce your eyes. You saw her passing your corral and you were physically attracted to her. Starve this attraction by bouncing your eyes. Don't dwell on her beauty by stealing glances. Do this with zeal. Avoid her. Sometimes this isn't possible, but do it when you can. If she works with you and the two of you are assigned to the same project, don't ask her to eat lunch with you or offer her a ride home. Avoid opportunities that create positive experiences with her until the attraction phase dies. If she asks you to do something with her, excuse yourself. When you're in her company, play the dweeb. Our hero, Dweeb Man, steps into a nearby public restroom and emerges as the polyester-clad enemy of all things flirtatious and hip. Dull, mild-mannered Dweeb Man, pocket protector shielding his heart and hair slightly askew, wages his quiet, thankless war of boring interchange. Our once-threatening Amazon withdraws to undefended sectors, leaving Dweeb Man victorious again in his never-ending good fight to stave off the hip and the impure in his galactic empire. Okay, there's not that much glory in playing the dweeb. There'll be no comic book deals, no endorsement deals, no 2020 interviews with Barbara Walters, but you'll be a hero to your wife and kids. A dweeb is the opposite of a player. In relationships, players send and receive social signals smoothly. Dweebs do not. When a player wants to send attraction signals, there are certain things he'll do. He'll flirt, he'll banter, he'll smile with a knowing look. He'll talk about hip things. In short, he'll be cool. You were a player at one time. You knew how to feed attractions. You spent your whole adolescence learning how. As a married man, however, a little social suicide is very much in order. Always play the dweeb. Players flirt. Learn to unflirt. Players banter. Learn to unbanter. If a woman smiles with a knowing look, learn to smile with a slightly confused look, to unsmile. If she talks about things that are hip, talk about things that are unhip to her, like your wife and kids. She'll find you pleasant enough, but rather bland and uninteresting. Perfect. Sometimes a woman's attractiveness to you will be mental rather than physical. This is common in work environments as you work with women on projects that interest you both. In business, it's common to spend more hours per day with female coworkers than with your wife. You talk with them about common goals and achieving success, while all you and your wife talk about are the kids' discipline problems, who's going to change the dirty diapers, and bills, bills, bills. As with physically attractive women, you must understand that if your shields aren't up, and if you don't recognize the threat to your marriage, you're flirting with danger. To summarize, if you're attracted to a woman, it doesn't mean you may never again have any sort of relationship or friendship with her. It only means you must enact your defense perimeters. Once you've starved the attractions and she's a safe distance away, you can have a proper relationship, one that is honoring to your wife and to the Lord. Women who find you attractive. No matter what our age or our waistlines, we're still capable of saying preposterous things like, "Finally, here is a woman who clearly has good taste and knows handsome when she sees it. I simply must get to know her better." Yes, guys still make those statements. Ed, being short on cash, took a second job working an early shift at FedEx to make ends meet. He was simply doing what a man should do for his family during a serious financial crunch. When Christy, an aggressive, attractive dispatcher, pranced by Ed's corral, she said, "You're so cute and sexy. I love to wrap my legs around men like you." She bantered and flirted at every turn, teasing with double entendres and come-ons. She spread her legs slightly whenever they talked, and her shirt often flopped open for him. One day she said, "My husband is out of town hunting for the weekend. I am going to be so lonely. Red alert, red alert." An hour later, Ed found her house key on his desk with a note saying, "I've left you this key in case you need to get into my house this weekend." Ed, to his credit, returned her key and let it be known in no uncertain terms that he would not be coming, and he asked her to stop what she was doing. Ed kept the gate to his corral closed because Christy was threatening everything he held dear. If a gang of ravenous teens were outside your home, approaching with axes and clubs, you would probably sense a threat. Red alert, shields up. Just as dangerous is the woman who finds you attractive. You must stop her by returning no attraction signals. If she's a non-Christian, she's even more dangerous since she has no moral reason not to go to bed with you. Your second line of defense is using your shield of rights. I have no right to think these thoughts, and I have no right to return these signals. Jesus died a bloody death on the cross to purchase you. He has all the rights here. You have none. Speak this out loudly to yourself again and again. It breaks and reins in the Mustang mind. Don't dawdle about getting your shields up. In one Star Trek movie episode, the enemy had captured a Federation starship and was approaching Kirk and the starship Enterprise, the good guys. The enemy commander didn't respond to any calls from Kirk. As Kirk hailed him repeatedly, the enemy commander simply sneered, "Let them eat static." Kirk found this lack of response peculiar. Confused and unsure of the intentions of the approaching ship, he dawdled. He did not put up his shields. Finally, when close enough, the enemy blasted away, severely disabling the Enterprise. Kirk paid a dear price for dawdling, losing his best friend to death in the ensuing interchanges. When a woman approaches your corral, you don't know what her intentions are. Maybe you're misreading her bright, outgoing personality and she isn't attracted to you at all. Maybe she greets everyone that way. Maybe not. There may be an enemy on that ship. Get your shields up and ask questions later. Don't pay that dear price. What do you do when someone finds you attractive? How do you starve these attractions? Here are some guidelines. Spend absolutely no time alone with this woman, even in public places. The reason is simple. You don't want to feed her attractions. Make it obvious you aren't returning her interest in you. Flee from her. Don't smile knowingly at her. Don't join her prayer group. Don't join her worship team. Avoid working with her on a committee. Don't be anywhere that she can be further impressed with you. Do this consciously and methodically. Prepare with war game simulations. What will you say if she calls you at work? What will you do if she invites you to lunch? Josh McDowell tells teens to decide what they'll do in the back seat of the car before they ever get to the back seat of the car. Otherwise, passion rules and reasoning isn't clear. As adults, we applaud his advice to teenagers. Why not follow Josh's words ourselves? Send absolutely no return attraction signals. Don't answer the call. Let them eat static. Play the dweeb. Help her out. Show her that her initial attraction to you was a ridiculous mistake. Choose to be boring and do it fastidiously. Later, when she's no longer attracted to you, you can be your normal, interesting self again. Chapter 16. Inside Your Corral. For those women who are already within your corral, the situation becomes rather complicated. These women won't drift back to the horizon. They're in your corral today and probably will be there tomorrow and the next day. This means you must eliminate these attractions in some other way. Let's look at the two main categories of women within your corral: old girlfriends and ex-wives, and wives of your friends. Again, not every woman in these categories will be attractive to you. But if one of these women catches your fancy or has retained a piece of your heart, something must be done. Each category has unique dangers and each demands unique defenses. So let's take a look at what we should do. From Fred, Old Flame. An old girlfriend or an ex-wife can be deadly to mental purity. Such attractions break you down in two ways. They weaken your ability to move toward one flesh with your wife, and they enable Satan to fire a cruise missile with little warning into your marriage. I had a heart-stopping summer romance with Polly following my freshman year of college. At the end of the summer, I left her to return to school in California. Lonely and heartsick, I wandered aimlessly through my days, feeling sorry for myself. We wrote every day and telephoned often. This went on for much of the fall quarter. One day, during an intramural football game, my eyes caught sight of a female referee. She looked like a grown-up version of my childhood sweetheart, Melody Knight, who had moved to Canada when we were in the third grade. After the game, I walked up and asked her what her name was. That was the extent of my lines in those days. Had she said Melody, I'd have instantly fallen for her. Instead, she said her name was Betsy, and I fell for her instantly anyway. As you can see, if anyone ever needed good defenses, it was me. My attraction to Betsy played itself out fairly soon. Meanwhile, Polly wondered why the letters and phone calls stopped. When I finally got the nerve to tell her there was someone else in my life, she was hurt deeply. When my little relationship with Betsy ended, I asked Polly for mercy and a second chance, but she would have none of it. Loyalty meant everything to her, and my breach of loyalty killed any attraction she felt for me. But I was no quitter. I fought on, longing for her for many years. Whenever I had a new girlfriend and things turned stormy, I dreamed of Polly, wishing she were mine. Everything would be different with Polly, I'd moan. Polly eventually married and had two children, but I was still so hooked that after a separation from her husband, I begged for her love again. This was before I met Brenda, of course. "Kids, debts, baggage, I'll carry them all just to have you back," I begged. You could have made a syrupy movie about my puppy love for Polly. With such an image of undying love for Polly, it's no wonder that when I finally fell in love with Brenda and married her, I didn't know what was coming. A tranquil tunnel of love? More like a roller coaster. Brenda and I had our share of fights, starting just days after the honeymoon. In fact, at times during our first 2 years of marriage, I wish I had never heard of the institution. Most of our conflicts were over in-laws, especially after my family engaged my new bride in a war and I got caught in the middle. The fights were hot and withering. Being young, we didn't know how to fight fair with each other or with our family members, so the collateral damage was great. We both suffered major losses. Guess who popped into my thought life? As my marriage spiraled downward, Polly spiraled upward into my thoughts. Well, Polly always got along with my family. They loved her. Around the holidays, I mused how peaceful life would have been with Polly. Why can't Brenda get along with my family? After all, Polly could. No right. One night, I was driving on an Iowa road between Fort Dodge and Harcourt. The moon was full, and the air was crisp and clear. As Polly popped into my head, an insight popped in as well, and I said to myself, "You have no right to any relationship of any type with Polly anymore, even in your thoughts." What? No right to even think about her? That's right, buddy, no right to even think of her. How stark. My mind rebelled fiercely, and the fight was on. My mind liked Polly, and it fought for her. In the end, however, truth prevailed, and I knew I'd forsaken all others on my wedding day. This promise had to become true in practice and not just in words. Polly had been a girlfriend and had long been inside my corral, but it was time for me to open the gate and show her out. She had a husband whose hopes and dreams were tied up in her, and she had children who loved her. I had no right to my thoughts, even if Polly knew nothing and she didn't. Besides, Brenda deserved better from me. I needed to capture my thoughts about Polly and obliterate my attraction to her. I found the process far simpler than I thought it would be. I obliterated all memory anchors, destroying every old card, letter, and picture of her. All traces of Polly were eliminated, just as God's people were supposed to do with the Canaanites when they entered the Promised Land. These actions improved the situation. But Polly's anchors weren't the only issue. I had to destroy my memories of her as well, because they stood in opposition to God's desires and hopes for my marriage. How do I do that, I wondered. I wasn't sure, but I had to try. First, I prayed for understanding and insight, since I didn't know what I was doing. Then I stumbled ahead as best I knew how. I began by using the shield of rights every time Polly entered my head. I coldly stated, "I have no right to think about Polly, and I won't." Having said that, I would sing a hymn or quote a scripture. Why? In the early days, I found that if I cast out a thought, a void remained. Without filling the void, Polly thoughts rushed back in. So I sang softly to fill the voids. It was a tough battle at first. As a hymn ended, Polly might immediately return, so sometimes it took numerous verses. In due time, I'd always win the skirmish, but within a few hours or a few days, the thoughts returned, and I'd fight again. During those days, I remember thinking, I cannot take chances by simply detaining these captive thoughts in a detention center. I must nuke these thoughts. That was a bit corny, but I knew that there must be no question of victory when this battle was over. Over time, I began winning decisively. With practice, I could actually grab an incoming impure thought and toss it out without singing, without filling the void. I could will it to be gone, and it would go. After yet more time, thoughts of Polly stopped entirely. My brain finally understood that Polly thoughts were unapproved. Satan's cruise missiles. As mentioned earlier, however, there is a second danger in not taking care of business with the attractions inside the corral. If you're careless, Satan can fire a cruise missile into your marriage and shatter your world in a moment. Years ago, I noticed a problem with Don, a married friend. He hadn't told me so, but several times when I was at his home, I noticed his finger hesitate on the TV remote when passing sex scenes on the movie channels. While the hesitation was nearly imperceptible, I saw it easily. His eyes had no defense, so I knew what he'd been watching. What I didn't know until it was too late was what he'd also been thinking. Don and his wife were having problems. To him, the worst were the sexual frustrations. "Joanne just doesn't fulfill me," he told me. "It wouldn't take much because I don't ask for much. All I wanted was to French kiss with her, and she wouldn't do it. We'd be messing around, and as things heated up, I'd try some French kissing. She always got angry and pulled away. She says it's filthy and makes her nauseous. I don't see how French kissing is any filthier than any other kiss. It's the same saliva. Besides, the Bible says that her body is not her own, but it's actually mine. The Bible gives me a right to sexual fulfillment, and as my wife, she owes me sexual fulfillment. It wasn't fair, and I didn't know what to do." Actually, Don had already decided on what to do, and that was to turn his thoughts to his old girlfriend, where he could daydream about her French kisses and what might have been. She loved French kissing. Don was ripe for the taking. He hadn't heard from this old flame in years, and he figured his thoughts were harmless. What could they hurt? He didn't even know where she was, but Satan did. Out of the blue, she called Don and said she'd be in town. Don's unguarded mind raced with the possibilities at a time when his defense perimeters were down. The two of them landed in a hotel room. Boom. He didn't think it could happen to him, but in one smashing blow, his marriage was blasted to smithereens. He couldn't say no. Bottom line, you have no right to any relationship with an old girlfriend or ex-wife if you still nurture an attraction to her. Friends' wives. You may think affairs like Don's happen so infrequently that you can confidently say, "Well, I would never do such a thing." But words like that mean nothing if you have any sense. We urge you, please protect yourself. Don't be defenseless because you can get fooled. Far too much is at stake to be sloppy with your defenses with anyone, and that includes the wives of your friends. If your best friend gave you all his worldly goods and told you to take care of them, you would probably invest wisely and take no chances. More important, you should take no chances with his wife, his most precious love of all. Have you ever had an attraction to a friend's wife at any time? Without defense perimeters, you've probably had many attractions. You're a man. Attractions happen. What do? Again, you start with the truth. I have no right to any relationship with my friend's wife apart from my relationship with my friend. Remember especially that there's nothing more dangerous than talking to a friend's wife when things are dry in either your marriage or her marriage. It's not that you don't trust your friend's wife. It's that you don't want to start anything. She should be like a sister to you with no hint of attraction between you. You'll always have some relationship with your friend's wife, but limit it to when your friend is around. This isn't always possible, but these simple rules can shield you from surprise attacks within the corral. First, limit all conversations between you and your friend's spouse unless your wife or your friend is with you. Keep things light and short, like vanilla. Second, if you phone your friend and he isn't home, get off the line with his wife promptly. Don't be rude, but don't plan on talking more than briefly with her. Third, if you stop by your friend's house and he isn't home, she may invite you in. What do then? Politely decline to enter. What possible purpose is served by staying? And fourth, capture any attractions toward your friend's wife and nuke them totally. Return to the rules of starving the eyes and taking such thoughts captive. Never ever tell yourself, oh, I can handle it, no problem. You need to deliberately tear away the thoughts so she doesn't see the attraction signals and decide to send back a few of her own. Leave her no opportunity to send a return signal. You may view these precautions as overly strict and tight, but we're counseling safety measures. In practice, this approach isn't restrictive. Your friends' wives are with your friends most of the time, so the rules don't apply that often. You're rarely alone with a friend's spouse. What God has put together, let no man tear asunder. Protect your friends' hopes and dreams as diligently as you're protecting your own hopes and dreams. You're his friend. Given the divorce statistics within the church, a simple defense perimeter isn't too much to ask of yourself. And some advice for a special situation. If you're single and a close female friend gets married, be willing to quickly and graciously let the friendship drift away. Marriage changes things. She's no longer the same person. Mysteriously, she is now one flesh with another man. She needs to be about building her marital relationship and finding couple friends together with him. From Fred, Learning a Lesson. Before I knew Brenda, my best friend was a woman named Terry who lived in the apartment above me. She had a boyfriend to whom she was perfectly loyal, and I wasn't in the market for a girlfriend at the time, so we paired well. We would often sit for hours as she talked about her insecurities, fears, and frustrations. I had just moved back to Iowa from California, and she was the only close friend I had. Then I met Brenda, whom I courted mostly by phone during our 7-month romance. Since she lived in another city 3 hours away, Brenda had little to do with Terry. Shortly after we were married, I told Brenda that I was planning to have lunch with Terry the following Wednesday. Why? Brenda asked. To catch up on things, mostly. And I'm not invited? Well, she's having some personal problems she wants to talk over with me, and since you don't know each other, she would probably feel uncomfortable sharing them in front of you. I'm not sure I like that. Why? I asked. We've always been just friends. Well, for one thing, she explained, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with us having friends of the opposite sex without each other. Besides, it looks bad for you to have lunch with a single woman alone. What if someone from church saw you? I just don't feel right about it. You trust me, don't you? I trust you. And she has a boyfriend, so I trust her motives for now. But what if her motives change down the line? I won't be there to spot it. I pondered Brenda's reasoning and eventually canceled the lunch date. It made sense. I'd learned that it wasn't appropriate for me to have lunch with Terry. I was glad I listened to Brenda's advice. As my own marriage struggled during the first 2 years, I was glad I only had to deal with the memories of Polly. Had Terry been around, who knows what would have happened. Though we were never romantically involved, our closeness and intimacy might have turned romantic. As a new Christian, would I have been able to resist falling for her? Given my track record, I'm glad Brenda dismissed that friendship early on. Some would say that all such friendships with the opposite sex should die once one marries. While I wouldn't go that far, I will say that such friendships must be guarded. To be careful is to be wise. Sacrifice and blessing. In the final quest, Rick Joyner writes, "Spiritual maturity is always dictated by our willingness to sacrifice our own desires for the desires of others or for the interests of the kingdom. Purifying your eyes and mind is more than a command, it's also a sacrifice. And as you make that sacrifice, as you lay down your desires, blessings will flow. Your spiritual life will experience new joy and power, and your marriage life will blossom as your relationship reaches new heights. Experiencing that relationship with all your heart is what the final part of this book will be about. The Heart of a Woman." Brenda hated this section. "Men seem like untrustworthy pigs whose minds and thoughts just go wherever they want," she commented. "Is nothing sacred to them? As women, do we trust men after reading this? You can't even trust a pastor to be a pure person. I feel that if anything ever happened to Fred, I'd never remarry because I would have very little trust in men." Brenda also thought Fred presented himself as an untrustworthy man in this chapter, especially while talking about Polly and Terry. She said men may not read it that way, but women will. We won't deny her comments because Fred was untrustworthy. How could he help it? For men, attractions seem to just happen. It's part of being male. Of course, women can also be attracted to other men. It just doesn't happen as often as men being attracted to women. Brenda said, I rarely ever pay much attention to other men. I might notice a good-looking guy, but I never give it more than a passing thought. Before marriage, I used to worry whether I would ever be attracted to someone else. For some reason, that has never come close to happening. I suppose it could happen to women who have unfaithful husbands or whose husbands are lazy toads or insensitive couch potatoes. Dina agreed. I really have trouble understanding this. As a woman, I don't have this problem. Kathy, on the other hand, gave a slight concession. When I see a physically attractive man, I may look and appreciate, but I don't dwell. I've learned to get past the infatuation stage and figure that he's someone who probably has bad breath, picks his nose, and sleeps around on his wife. Even if he doesn't, I have no right to fantasize about this person. Some men seem to have little problem in this area. Both Andrea and Heather said that though their husbands have had problems with their eyes, they were sure their husbands didn't face this particular problem with their minds. Of course, most attractions facing men are not sudden, and the slower-forming attractions are the most dangerous. Even women without attraction buttons are subject to these slow-forming attractions, and they must be prepared, too. The statistics on adultery are stunning, and both sexes need to understand how dangerous attractions can be. Part 6. Victory in Your Heart. Chapter 17. Cherishing Your One and Only. Your outer defense perimeters, protecting your eyes and your mind, will defend against sexual impurities, guaranteeing that your wife remains beyond compare in your eyes. Now let's talk about a third perimeter, your innermost perimeter, which is about being consumed with God's purpose to cherish your wife, where your commitment to God shows first. If Christians were consumed by God's purposes, it would first be reflected in our marriages. But the rates of divorce, adultery, and marital dissatisfaction in the Christian church reveal our hearts. We've known very few men consumed by their marriages, and fewer still consumed by purity, but both are God's desire for you. God's purpose for your marriage is that it parallels Christ's relationship to His church, that you be one with your wife. But what does the standard of Christ's relationship to His church have to do with our sexual purity? In our hearts, we often have selfish attitudes and expectations regarding our wives. When these expectations aren't met, we become grumpy and frustrated. Our will to maintain our outer defense perimeters is eroded. Well, if this is how she's going to be, why should I go through all the effort of being pure? She doesn't deserve it. We retaliate by withdrawing from our own responsibilities, but cherishing our wives includes being sexually pure. If this inner defense fails, the outer perimeter of the eyes and mind can also fail, and quite quickly. Perhaps you're finding it difficult to cherish your one and only. We understand that sentiment. To cherish means to treat with tenderness and to hold dear, and you want to feel the romantic urge to do those things. But what if you don't feel like it? Something with such ramifications upon your sexual purity and upon the very strength of your marriage cannot be left to feelings alone. How cherishing feels. Just how does cherishing feel? Does your wife feel cherished? For centuries, the Song of Solomon has often been viewed as an allegory of how Christ feels for His bride and how she feels in return. Keep that interpretation in mind as you read the portions below, condensed from chapters 4 through 7. Look first at Jesus' feelings toward His bride. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Your hair is like royal tapestry. The king is held captive by its tresses. How beautiful you are, and how pleasing, O love, with your delights. Song of Songs, chapter 4, verses 1, 3, 7, 9, and 10, and chapter 7, verses 5 and 6. Now observe the church's feelings toward Jesus. My lover, husband, is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is purest gold. His hair is wavy and black as a raven. His mouth is sweetness itself. He is altogether lovely. This is my lover. This is my friend. I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me. Let us go early to the vineyards. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my lover. Song of Songs, chapter 5, verses 10, 11, and 16, chapter 7, verses 10, 12, and 13. Do you sense Jesus' desire for you as part of his bride? In return, does your heart yearn for him like this? Because our marriage relationships should parallel Christ's relationship to the church, our feelings for our wives should parallel these passages. What a great reminder of how exciting love can be, especially when channeled toward the one God intended for us to have. From Fred, Caught Up in Conditions. Do you feel these things for your wife? I haven't always. Do you remember pop quizzes from school? A sort of diabolical truth serum used by evil teachers to expose your knowledge or lack of it to the world? God loves pop quizzes, but he doesn't test our knowledge with them. He tests our character. I'm reminded of that when I recall the times during our first 2 years of marriage when Brenda and I were staggered by in-law problems with my family. Our marriage was quickly wilting away. One Valentine's Day, I went to buy a card. Without warning, this turned into a pop quiz from God. Fingering through the cards, I read the texts. One by one, I returned them to the racks as too mushy, too contrived, or too romantic. Little by little, panic set in as I sensed the inevitable. Not one Valentine's card in the store could be sent by me with any measure of sincerity. Head down, I scurried from the store, recognizing the depth of our loss. My grade on the quiz? Sickening. What about you? Are you cherishing your wife? Do you feel cherished? If not, you probably got there the same way I did, by stopping short of God's standards. God's standard is to unconditionally cherish her no matter what. No conditions. But in America, we've added mealy-mouthed terms to form conditional contracts. If I were living according to God's purposes, I'd have added no conditions. But in my marriage, my conditions were that I would cherish Brenda if she made peace with my family and shaped up. When we set conditions, we fix our gaze on what we expect to get from the marriage. There's nothing wrong with expecting something, of course. But in pre-marriage classes, I always ask the question, what do you expect to get out of your marriage that you can't get by staying single? We hope for an Eden where our needs are met and our dreams are fulfilled. The problem comes when we expect our wives to deliver these things under contractual conditions. With Brenda, anger and resentment erupted when I felt she didn't carry her side of the bargain. I no longer felt like cherishing her. With that kind of focus, oneness in a marriage can't grow. For instance, Bill said this about his wife. She was showing such a lack of ambition. What I expected when we got married was that we would both continue in our careers and really build our lives financially in our early years. She just isn't doing what I thought she'd do, and she really seems kind of lazy and selfish. Then she got pregnant. After a few months, she said, I don't like the way I look anymore, so I don't want to have sex until after the baby comes. I found that so unfair. The thought of no sex bothered me the more I thought about it, and I thought that if she were just going to live any way she pleased, I would live any way I pleased. I have a biblical right to sexual fulfillment, and I'll have it one way or another. That's how I came to have an affair. That's a flimsy excuse for adultery. But its seeds were in Bill's focus on what he wanted out of the marriage. These kind of conditional contracts don't work because they're written as we go along. Regardless of how long we date, we don't really know each other well enough to cover the hidden or changing conditions of the heart and mind. For instance, how could I have anticipated the huge problems with my family? And how could Brenda have anticipated my out-of-control temper? I broke holes in walls with my bare hands. I threw pots of bean soup across the kitchen floor. How could she have expected any of this? A conditional marriage contract originally defines what we hope to get out of marriage. As time passes and we learn more, we add more expectations and more requirements until we hardly recognize the agreement anymore. Wait a minute, this isn't working out like I expected. I'm getting out. Brenda and I came to a moment of truth sometime after that bean soup hit the floor. She simply said, "I don't know how else to say this. My feelings for you are dead." She wondered if we should consider divorce. Hearing that word stunned me. As a child of divorce, the old feelings of horror swept over me again. No matter how much gravel. Several days passed. One day when Brenda was at work, I stood before my refrigerator and reached in for a half gallon of milk. Her words lay heavily upon my chest. I poured the milk, shut the refrigerator door, and paused. I had to do something. Raising my right hand and pointing a finger toward heaven, I declared, "God, I don't care how much gravel I have to eat. I'll never get a divorce." I finally understood the promise I'd made on my wedding day. My promise wasn't conditional. If she fed me meat and potatoes, I would eat it. If she fed me gravel, I would eat it. I was going to change or tolerate or love in whatever way necessary, but I would keep my promise to love and cherish her, whatever the cost. What does eating gravel have to do with cherishing, you might ask? Do I give up everything I have to keep peace? What about my rights? Well, you do have a few rights, and we're not saying your wife has no responsibility in return. But in the countless ways we poke each other in this shared space called marriage, our focus needs to be on our sharp edges, not hers. God always knew marriages would wither when rooted in contracts, which is why he established unconditional covenants. He knew that conditions change. God never forgot what we often forget. Namely, the curse of Eden is a grinding curse. Life is a steamroller making pancakes of conditions and easily mashing the naive contracts we create. In our dreams for marriage, maybe we forget that we would still have to work long hours by the sweat of our brow to eat, and that we wouldn't always see each other as much as we wish. Maybe we forget that we will sometimes be beaten up and used by bosses, our minds so numb we just don't want to talk when we get home. Maybe we forget that with the pain in childbirth comes bodies that never regain their former shape. Any number of trials and tribulations might make conditions impossible to meet, but we demanded guarantees anyway, demanding some form of Eden from our marriages, when all the time our place is to cherish our wives unconditionally. That doesn't sound much like Eden to us. We don't like our place. So our inner defenses are let down and we lose our concern for God's purposes. A man with complete faithfulness. We want to direct your attention now to a man in the Bible who liked his place and loved God's purpose. All men should be as faithful as he was, cherishing both their king and their wives. This man's name was Uriah. In 1 Chronicles 11, we see Uriah listed as one of David's mighty men, the men who gave his kingship strong support to extend it over the whole land as the Lord had promised. Chapter 11, verse 10. Uriah was clearly consumed with the purposes of his king, David. He was also consumed with the purposes of God. Uriah was by David's side in the caves when Saul hounded their heels. He cried with David as their homes burned at Ziklag. He cheered himself hoarse at David's coronation, and he fearlessly fought to extend David's kingdom over the whole land. Swearing his life to the purposes of God, Uriah stood in harm's way for David's throne. Sound familiar? You swore your life to someone, didn't you? You swore before family and friends to honor and cherish your wife, abandoning all others. You promised she would have more from marriage than she would have as a single woman. Are you consumed by this commitment? Consumed enough to live faithfully and cherish her completely? Consumed enough to stand in harm's way and to eat gravel until God's purposes and your promises are finally established in your land? Uriah was that consumed. His faithfulness was complete, but alas, David's faithfulness wasn't. He went to bed with Bathsheba, Uriah's wife. When she became pregnant, he had a mess on his hands. As always, Uriah was out fighting David's battles. Bathsheba's pregnancy could mean only one thing. David, not Uriah, was the father. David addressed this situation by fabricating a ruse. He ordered Uriah back from the front lines. David's plan was to send Uriah quickly home to a warm, cuddly night with Bathsheba. If David moved quickly enough, people would naturally assume the unborn child was Uriah's. Tragically, Uriah's faithfulness to the king was so complete that David's plan didn't work. David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to his house. When David was told Uriah did not go home, he asked him, "Haven't you just come from a distance? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 8 through 13. Look at Uriah. He was so consumed by the purposes of God that he refused to go to his house even to wash his feet. His faithfulness was so strong that even when drunk, he didn't waver from his commitment and zeal. His purity of soul was so great that no treacherous trick formed against him could stand. God wouldn't allow David's simple deception to cover his great sin against God and against God's choice servant, Uriah. God loved Uriah, and God loved Uriah's love for Bathsheba. Uriah knew his place. He was satisfied to be part of God's purposes to fill his role. To be like Uriah, we must know our place and be content with it. Your ewe lamb. What does it mean to cherish? We needn't look further than Uriah's example because his cherishing heart toward Bathsheba was transforming. After David arranged for Uriah to be killed in battle,